portable fab lab? Grown crystal optics? Possibly laser-etched circuitry? Can we identify the factory? Another scientist weighed in.
Probably South Korean manufacturer, highest quality.
How long until we can get this test started, gentlemen?
The scientists at the lab benches were making last-minute calibrations to hundreds of knobs and dials on rack-mounted monitoring equipment. One of them turned to Phillips.
It will be a few minutes yet, Doctor.
Ross approached her and pointed to the HUD glasses.
You think this runs off the FOM?
Phillips reacted to Merritt's quizzical expression.
John means the Faction Operations Module, Agent Merritt. It's how the demon coordinates the activities of the humans who work for it. That's how it infiltrated corporate networks, that's how it identifies new threats, and that's how it distributes funds and privileges to its members. Basically, it's the key to its power. The FOM is a distributed mesh network consisting of tens of thousands of nodes. Each node has a unique encryption key at any given moment. If we can clone these glasses, we might have an opening we can exploit to infiltrate the demon's operations, possibly to shut it down.
Merritt nodded.
I'm all for that.
The major frowned at Phillips.
If the demon knows we're penetrating its defenses, it might lash out and start destroying companies.
If we're careful, it will never know, Major.
She reacted to his grim expression.
Look, demon operatives coordinate their activities somehow, and so far we've been unable to find even a single email or IM message between them. We're missing something, and both John and I believe that that something is sitting right in front of us. Unless we conduct this test, we'll have no chance at all of stopping the demon.
What exactly does this test entail, Doctor?
Phillips pointed at the captured glasses.
We plan on powering up these glasses so we can see what a demon operative sees while working on the demon's darknet.
The Major still looked doubtful. He pointed at the wires and cables running from the glasses and back toward the lab benches.
And this?
The Chinese scientists stepped in.
Sound and video outputs. We'll record the images projected onto the heads-up display of the glasses for later analysis. We'll also project the images onto these monitors here.
Nothing's hooked into our computer network.
Phillips crossed her arms impatiently.
Major, it's hooked to a DV camera. A camera whose embedded OS has been cleared of serial numbers. Please give us more credit than that. Now, unless the DOD has any objections, I'd like to conduct this test before the demon decides that this operative is KIA.
The Major took one last look around. He nodded grimly.
Okay, Doctor. Proceed.
Phillips turned to the scientists.
Let's do it, gentlemen.
They tripped several switches.
Activating computer fuel cell.
The glasses have electrical power.
Numerous television monitors mounted above the workbench filled with information. The scientists looked pleased.
Good. The computer belt has established a secure link to a nearby WiMAX transmitter. Let's get a fix on its location.
Another scientist called out,
An encrypted link has been established between the glasses and the computer belt.
Retinal scanning in progress. Stand by.
Phillips took a deep breath.
Cross your fingers, people.
They all stared at the glasses, but nothing obvious was happening. They waited. The lead scientist smiled and turned toward them.
We're receiving data. I believe we just fooled the demon.
A cheer went up, and high fives were exchanged at the lab benches. The Major was impassive as always. Phillips, Ross, Merritt, and the Major moved to join the scientists crowding around video monitors. The screens displayed images being beamed onto the lenses of the HUD glasses. The Major squinted.
What are we looking at?
Phillips answered.
It's a graphical user interface of some type. Local time, GPS coordinates, power level, shield. Shield? That's interesting.
Ross pointed at the screen.
It looks like one of Sobel's game interfaces. A menu of options like a first-person shooter.
The Major scowled.
But what's this tell us?
Ross read through the visible menus.
There's no obvious way to navigate the UI.
How do they work it?
The lead scientist nodded.
The glasses have a built-in bone conduction microphone. Could it be voice-activated?
We don't have a voice pattern for this demon operative.
Phillips pointed at a small blue square glowing near the right side of the screen.
What's this?
Barely legible text appeared just above the box, reading AAW-9393G28. It was connected to the box by a glowing line. Ross concentrated on the screen.
I'd say it's a call-out. Looks like there's an object still active in our captured equipment collection.
You mean like the name call-outs hovering over characters in Sobel's online games?
One way to find out.
Ross approached the armature holding the HUD glasses.
What are you doing?
I'm going to turn these glasses. If that glowing box moves on screen as I move the glasses, then we know the glasses are showing us a virtual demon object that's bolted to an external coordinate system, most likely the GPS grid.
Merritt looked from Phillips to Ross.
Why would it create virtual objects on the GPS grid?
Ross called over from the rig as he turned it.
In Sobel's online games, players and significant objects in the 3D environment are denoted by virtual callouts, pop-up menus that hover in space, providing information. I believe Sobel created the same system using the GPS grid.
He turned to Phillips.
How's that?
The group looked stunned.
Oh my God.
What is it?
Ross moved over to the monitor. The tiny glowing box paled in significance, hovering eerily in virtual space beyond the real walls of the lab. Was a towering red call-out box ringed with a dozen mysterious and dangerous-looking symbols. Skulls, X's, and crosses. Beneath that was a line reading, 40, Sorcerer. At the top of the call-out was a rolling row of letters like tumblers cycling endlessly next to the word, Stormbringer.
What the hell is that, John?
Ross studied the video feed.
That's the call-out of a 40th level sorcerer. We've been infiltrated.
The major leaned in toward the screen.
Where is he?
In this building.
Ross moved side to side to get some parallax on the call-out.
He's in the gaming pit.
Ross turned to the major.
Call security, now!
The major shouted to a nearby guard.
Notify CECOM that we have a highly dangerous intruder in the gaming pit. Activate silent lockdown.
The guard reached for his radio, but the major put his hand over it and pointed to the nearby phone.
Use a landline, you idiot.
The guard nodded.
Sorry, Major.
Ross pointed at the screen.
We've got half the talent on the task force in that room.
Phillips turned on the major.
Just how the hell did he get in here, Major?
Let's worry about that once we have the mole in custody. I'll tell you this much. Britlin is going to have hell to pay.
Britlin? Who is Britlin?
The company that clears task force candidates.
Phillips looked at him like he was insane.
The government outsourced our background checks?
Britlin has worked with the intelligence sector for 30 years, Doctor. This is standard operating procedure.
What about the current situation seems standard to you?
Merritt started loosening his tie.
We need to take him out before he can react. Let me go in there with a can of mace.
The major shook his head.
Negative, Agent Merritt. We have people on site.
No offense, Major, but I do this for a living.
We have 30 ex-SOCOM soldiers, counter-insurgency experts, each with more than a decade of experience. Delta Force, OSNAS, SFB.
Merritt stopped preparing himself.
Well, I see you were expecting trouble.
Ross was still moving back and forth, trying to pinpoint the intruder's location on a printed floor plan.
He's one of the gamers along the back wall of the pit. User 23, 24, or 25.
Phillips turned to the scientists.
This intruder must be linked into the demon's darknet. Can you jam his connection?
The lead scientist looked dour.
We're not configured to jam signals in the gaming pit, Doctor.
Major, we need that mole taken alive if at all possible.
The Major nodded toward the distant blast doors.
Let's get to the security control room. We'll direct the op from there.
Chapter 43, Enemy Within. The glass security doors of the gaming pit opened silently, admitting a core strike team, half a dozen heavily armed men wearing Kevlar helmets, gas masks, and black body armor. They entered in close formation, single file, guns aimed over each other's shoulders. The white core logo was just a large stylistic K, like a heraldic symbol on their black helmets and breastplates. Across the room, another set of glass doors opened, revealing a second core strike team identical to the first. The team leaders exchanged hand signals, then advanced in unison. They were a steely-eyed professional bunch with automatic weapons, tasers, and beanbag guns at the ready. They moved as one, threading rapidly through the tangle of workstations toward their target. They clearly knew their business. The strike teams fanned out, aiming toward the far corner of the room. As they moved in, several of them held up printed signs reading, "Danger. Do not speak. Leave immediately." White hat gamers looked up one by one, nudging each other. Their game chatter died down, but the guards took up chatter of their own to compensate.
Team 2, cover that left flank.
Stop bunching up.
Cover that exit.
Clear the field of fire.
The strike teams kept up a steady stream of talk as they formed into a wedge focused directly on the target, the three gamers in the corner of the room. They could see the gamers' heads dodging left and right beyond flat panel monitors, reacting to what was displayed on their computer screens. All three men were completely absorbed in their games. The forward team leader held up three gloved fingers and pointed directly at the players in the corner. Best to take all three down. The strike teams were still tugging stunned gamers aside, holding up a finger for silence, then pointing to the exits. Finally, the two strike teams were in position, arrayed around their quarry at a distance of 10 or 12 feet. They stared at the heads of three gamers, patches of close-cropped, spiky hair. The ambient chatter had died down now, and the targeted gamers appeared to sense something was up. They glanced around as the last of their neighbors scurried to safety. They were isolated. Silence finally fell upon the room, except for the stereo sound effects of nearby 3D games. One of the core team leaders touched a microphone switch on his gas mask and shouted in an amplified radio voice,
"Users 23, 24, and 25, remain seated and put your hands where we can see them. This is not a drill."
The two gamers on the left immediately raised their hands in the air and looked up in utter shock. When they got a look at the dozen weapons pointed in their direction, they turned a shade paler than they already were. The young guy on the right remained motionless, still sitting behind his monitor.
"User 25, put your hands where we can see them, now!"
The team leader motioned for the two users on the left to clear the area. They were happy to oblige, and as they complied, two guards pepper-sprayed them in the face. They collapsed, screaming as the guards zipped hand ties onto their wrists. It was done with expert swiftness and precision, like calf roping in a rodeo, and in no time, the guards were back on their feet, weapons ready. User 25 was now isolated. A couple of dozen eyes memorized the top of his head through gun sights. Bright laser dots clustered on his scalp. The booming radio voice kept up the pressure.
"Show your hands, now!"
User 25 took a deep breath.
"This is a mistake."
"Hands where we can see them or we open fire."
"A big mistake."
"I said hands in the air."
User 25 finally raised his hands. They were wrapped in jet black gloves with silver caps, like thimbles, on the end of each index finger. Something was set in the palms of each hand, like a large crystal. Suddenly, a white-hot flash several times brighter than the sun pulsed through the room, followed closely by a second flash from User 25's other hand. It took several moments for the light to flare down. The strike teams were initially stunned, but then needles of agony burned into their brains. They dropped their weapons as they collapsed onto their knees, grabbing at their eyes and clawing their gas masks off their faces, screaming. Brian Gregg kicked his chair away and stood up from the gaming workstation. As the blinded strike team members writhed on the floor crying out, Gregg moved calmly toward the burly team leader who had shouted at him. Gregg aimed a silver-capped index finger at the man, a lens at its very tip. Black fiber optic and electrical cables ran down the back of Gregg's hands like veins, disappearing beneath his shirt.
"The name is Loki, asshole."
A ruler-straight bolt of electricity cracked like a bullwhip from his fingertip into the man's body armor, followed by a flickering series of bolts in quick succession, three a second. The team leader's muscles jerked with each thunderclap. The smell of ozone filled the air. After the last crack, Gregg lowered his hand, and the team leader dropped dead to the ground, his body smoking and sizzling. Grimacing from the pain in his eyes, the other team leader glanced around blindly and shouted,
"Who's shooting?"
"That's not shooting!"
"Hooks!"
A pause.
"Where's Hooks?"
"Get to cover and sound off! Sound off!"
Gregg moved toward the fallen men. He pointed and let loose with several seconds of deafening thunderclaps. Men crawled away screaming, only to be immobilized the moment the first bolt hit them. In a few seconds, they were all motionless or convulsing. The sickening smell of burnt hair came to Gregg's nostrils.
"What the hell just happened?"
Phillips stared at a bank of security monitors. The security command center was packed with core security folks pointing at monitors and barking into radios. The major snapped his fingers at the control board operator.
"Get on the horn to Wayburn Labs. Tell them we might be facing an illicit Lip-C weapon. I need countermeasures and tactics."
Merritt watched the intruder on the monitor.
"What's a Lip-C weapon?"
"Laser-induced plasma channel. Uses laser light as a virtual wire for electricity."
"Where did he get it?"
"The demon appears to be dipping into our research pipeline."
Phillips turned on him.
"Just how many sections of the intelligence apparatus have been compromised, Major?"
"Not now, Doctor. We've got men down."
Ross, Merritt, and Phillips stared at the large central monitor. There, the intruder was stepping among the fallen strike team members, sprawled on the floor of the gaming pit. The Major barked at the board operator.
"Seal zones 3 through 6. Let's contain this asshole."
Another Corps officer spoke up.
"I've got an identity on user 25, Michael Radcliffe, grad student, MIT.
The Major waved it aside.
"That's bullshit. Radcliffe's probably dead.
"Should we pump tear gas through the ventilation duct, sir?"
"Use your brain. There's a dozen gas masks in there with him."
The Major checked his watch.
"Call in an electronic warfare team and a demolitions team. We need to jam this fucker's uplink, then kill him."
He turned to nearby Corps officers.
"I want commercially marked choppers over our 20. Scramble the perimeter defense teams. Lethal force authorized. No one enters or leaves this facility until I say otherwise."
"Understood, Major."
Phillips pushed up to him.
"Major, we should try to take this man alive."
"We're not capturing anyone, Doctor. This situation is going to end right now, and whatever's left is all yours."
Ross pointed at the monitor.
"He's doing something."
They all looked up. The intruder was standing, moving his arms as though controlling invisible objects, his mouth moving in a rhythmic chant. Gregg concentrated on the plane of D-space. The entire floor plan of Building 29 was replicated there, spread out around him as a life-sized wireframe model overlaid on the GPS grid. It aligned precisely with the corners of each wall in the real world. This allowed Gregg to see the geometry of adjoining rooms. More importantly, images from the building's dense network of security cameras were wrapped around the wireframe model's geometry, showing a patchwork of live video from those neighboring rooms, giving Gregg an almost X-ray vision through the dense concrete. Corps personnel sprinted through the hallways, loading weapons and sealing doorways. They were ants in his ant colony. He had seen the strike teams getting ready all the way back in their locker room. The garrison was in disarray. Greg turned to look far beyond the concrete walls of Building 29 to distant, glowing callouts in D-Space. He selected dozens of virtual objects he'd stored there, then launched his prearranged summoning sequence, making somatic gestures and speaking the unlock code to the VOIP module.
Andos Ithran Kolra Bethru, Lord of a Million Eyes, Loki summons you.
Greg looked through the sealed blast doors leading into the lab. The guards there had been pulled inside, but Greg looked into the artificial dimension beyond them. He aimed a gloved finger at a virtual object in the lab, an object he had insinuated into the equipment collection some time ago. Greg closed his fist on the object in D-Space. Somewhere beyond those thick concrete walls, a compressed air tank sprayed powdered aluminum across the lab space, then ignited it with an electrical spark. Suddenly, the building shuddered, followed by a dull roar and the muted shrieks of twisting metal. A deafening klaxon sounded the alarm throughout the facility. Blue strobes flickered near the exits. The major scanned the security monitors as a dozen red lights blinked on a floor plan map. There, the lab was consumed in flames. The camera image rippled with interference, vertical holds skipping. One of the scientists ran through the picture, burning alive beneath white-hot flames. Sprinklers deployed to little effect.
God damn it!
The science team, get medics to the lab and the equipment collection!
It's too late. Ross pointed to the monitor. On screen, an acetylene tank was spinning in a pinwheel of flame near the lab table, then exploded, shaking the building again. The monitor image went dead. Philip slumped and covered her eyes.
We just lost some of our best people, not to mention the demon equipment collection.
Merritt grabbed the major's shoulder.
Where do you need me? Sit tight, Merritt.
The major looked back at Phillips.
Are you still glad you conducted your little test, Doctor?
Without this test, we never would have discovered we'd been infiltrated.
Ross nodded.
That's why we weren't able to join demon factions. He was tracking our every move.
The major turned to him.
Maybe we shouldn't have been playing games with the demon in the first place.
The board operator looked up again.
He's not going anywhere, Major. The gaming pit is locked down.
Greg stood before the sealed bulletproof glass doors barring his exit. The camera-lined corridor beyond led to the building entry vestibule. Greg turned to face another D-Space object hovering just to the right of the glass doors. It was a surreal blue button, floating impossibly there as seen through his HUD glasses. It was labeled in large glowing letters. Open. Greg tapped the virtual button with his gloved hand. It flashed. The real-world ballistic glass doors slid open, and he stepped through the opening and entered the anteroom beyond. Phillips threw up her hands.
He's out of the gaming pit.
Ross gestured to the monitors.
The security system's been compromised.
Who subcontracted that, I wonder?
The major gave her a look.
Stow that shit right now.
He turned to the board operator.
Physically cut power to the north perimeter doors.
The board operator rolled back in his chair. He opened an electrical panel on the back wall and started tripping breaker switches. Phillips leaned over the board and clicked from camera to camera.
Where is he?
Don't worry, Doctor. He's trapped.
That's what you said last time. Show me.
We just tripped the breakers. The perimeter doors are frozen in a locked position. He's not getting through inch-thick steel plating.
She studied the bank of black-and-white monitors. The large one in the center now showed the intruder standing in a dead-end hallway, some distance from the exterior steel doors. He stood above three newly fallen guards, their bodies smoking. The intruder was just staring up at the camera, unnervingly calm. He was just a kid, early 20s at most. The major nodded at the monitor.
I told you we'd stop him.
He turned to a nearby guard.
I want every gun on the tarmac focused on that exit.
Phillips leaned into the microphone sticking up from the control board. She held down the mic switch.
You're trapped. Give up and you won't be hurt.
The intruder's tinny voice came in over the speakers.
Dr. Phillips, I see you discovered D-space, or at least a layer of it.
A flash of fear swept through her.
He knew her real name. How could he possibly know her name?
Thoughts of her parents in D.C. thrust front and center in her mind. She turned to the major.
Call Dr. Fulbright at Fort Meade. Tell him to take my parents into protective custody. Now!
The major snapped his fingers at a Corps guard who grabbed another phone. She keyed the mic.
You know who I am, so who are you? Or are you afraid to tell me your name?
Bitch, I'm Loki, the most powerful sorcerer in the world, and I'm about to ruin your whole fucking day.
Merritt took off his suit jacket and headed for the door.
Keep this nutcase busy, Doctor. Ross grabbed Merritt's arm. No heroics, Roy.
I don't plan on any.
The major blocked his path.
Where are you going?
Merritt looked calmly at him.
I'm going to see how that prick deals with flashbang grenades. Unlock the gaming pit, Major.
The Major appraised Merritt for a moment, then grabbed a radio and headset from a nearby charging station. Images of Merritt as the Burning Man in Sobel's mansion flashed through his mind. He tossed them to Merritt.
Good luck.
The Major watched him exit. Phillips turned back to the monitor and keyed the mic again.
Loki, Sobel is using you. What you're doing is high treason. If you surrender now, I can help you.
You can help me? He laughed. I'm not the one who needs help. The society you're defending is doomed.
It's your society too, Loki.
No, it's my parents' society, not mine. What does it offer my generation? A meaningless existence. Living long, boring lives milked each day by salesmen. Livestock for a permanent ruling class. Well, I have no use for their laws, their maps, their failures. The demon has already defeated them.
This is your last warning. Surrender.
Loki smiled.
You don't get it, do you?
Philip sighed in exasperation and pounded the mic button again.
We physically cut the power to the door in front of you. Your hacks won't work. Even if you manage to get through the door, we've got snipers covering the tarmac. They'll cut you down from 200 meters downrange. Just surrender.
Loki shook his head.
You're not thinking in enough dimensions, Doctor. Only part of me is in this building.
Squads of heavily armored Corps security guards ran to take up positions next to a guard shack ringed with highway barriers and razor wire at the perimeter gate. Behind them, a quarter mile of bare tarmac stretched to the nearest hangar, but most of their attention was drawn inwards to Building 29 itself. They listened to their encrypted radios and the voice coming through it.
Shoot on sight! Repeat! Shoot on sight!
Copy that, CECOM. Out.
A bay breeze kicked up, sending scraps of paper tumbling over the expanse of concrete and flattening them against the chain-link fencing. Nearer to the building, another squad of Corps guards with scoped M4A1s rushed to take up positions in the staff parking lot, the best cover available. They took aim on the sealed steel doors of the building. The roar of speeding engines suddenly came in on the wind. One guard turned, then urgently grabbed his officer's shoulder, pointing.
Pass up!
They both turned to see one, then six, then 15, then 30 cars screaming in from several vectors along the runway, racing in through the gaps between distant hangar buildings. The cars swerved with remarkable coordination, all converging on Building 29 like a school of piranha.
Polizei?
The lieutenant blew a whistle, and everyone turned to face him. He pointed and shouted with an Afrikaans accent.
Incoming! Take cover! Might be car bombs!
Belay that!
The cars had already closed half the distance. More were issuing from between the distant hangars. The lieutenant keyed his radio.
CECOM, we have several dozen vehicles inbound at high speed. Code 30.
Nothing but static came back.
Scheiße!
He turned to his men.
Fire at will!
Automatic gunfire erupted from a score of positions. The shots cracked flatly in the open air of the runway. Tracer rounds ripped across the tarmac, ricocheting off the concrete and whining into the sky.
Knock out the lead cars! The lead cars!
A light anti-tank rocket blasted from their lines in a pall of smoke and detonated against a mid-sized car at 50 yards, turning it into a tumbling ball of flame. A black domestic sedan swerved around the wreckage and came roaring onwards. Half a dozen divots appeared in the black-tinted windshield at head level right in front of the driver's seat, revealing a high degree of marksmanship. Then, hundreds more bullets tore through its front grille. As its engine died, another car surged past it, and as that one was riddled with bullets, yet another took its place. Already 10 cars were smoking and rolling to a stop, but still more came on. The shooting died down as half the squad dropped clips and hurriedly reloaded.
Watch the left flank!
The lieutenant leaned around the guard shack just in time to see a car's front grille, which was the last thing he ever saw. The car crashed into the fence line and concrete highway divider at 110 miles per hour, disappearing into a cloud of concrete dust and debris as it tumbled end over end. It was immediately followed by three other sedans crashing through the gate. Automatic weapons stitched them full of bullet holes from several directions. Shouting filled the gaps in the gunfire. But other cars had already blasted through the fence line elsewhere, dragging great serrated lengths of chain-link fencing behind them. These caught guards across the thighs, tearing their flesh and dragging them screaming, even as other guards blasted out windows and peppered car bodies with bullets from SAWs with 200-round belts. Now, they could plainly see the cars were unmanned.
Detka nie wies, nie! Fall back! Fall back!
A car crashed into the edge of the parking lot, while two others careened off each other and slammed into a scattering pack of guards with such force that the guards' bodies hurtled 20 yards and landed in the bay, followed closely by the cars that hit them. They sent up geysers of water as they hit the surface. In the distance, more automates kept streaming through the gaps between warehouses. Merritt raced out into the gaming pit, Beretta drawn. Automatic gunfire crackled like popcorn somewhere outside.
Damn it.
Merritt slowed as he reached the still smoking bodies of the strike teams sprawled between the workstations. He knelt to feel the pulse of the nearest one. Nothing. He scavenged an HK UMP 40 caliber submachine gun with a web belt of extra clips and flashbang grenades, then spoke into his headset microphone.
Merritt to CECOM. What the hell's going on out there? Over.
The Major talked into a radio headset.
Agent Merritt, we're under attack. Stand by.
Inside the security control room, the sound of muffled automatic weapons fire was starting to be eclipsed by roaring engines and crashing. The Major watched the external monitors. One camera showed a head-on view of a driverless, bullet-riddled car nailing the camera pole, the screen filling with snow.
Why didn't they sound the alarm?
He was having trouble comprehending it.
This isn't a guerrilla raid. This is a frontal assault.
Ross examined the screens.
Computer-controlled vehicles, dozens of them. The factions call them automates.
The Major stared at the large central monitor on the control board, seemingly the only monitor not at present depicting mayhem. On screen, the intruder was busy moving his arms, manipulating invisible objects. He glanced up at the security camera. His voice came over the speaker.
I'll let myself out.
Just then, some 10 yards behind the intruder, the steel doors were staved in by a shredded mass of metal. The whole building shook with a dull thud, concrete dust sifting down through the seams. The intruder barely flinched. The car that had smashed in the steel doors was now entirely blocking the exit. But then, another unseen vehicle cut in from the side and ripped the first one out of the hole with a deafening crash. The opening was now clear. Merritt heard the first crash and saw sunlight streaming in from beyond the sealed ballistic doors. He loaded the UMP, and by the second crash, he was rushing toward the glass doors. Greg emerged into the sunlight through the shattered opening of the main door. As he did so, a silver BMW 740 with blacked-out windows rolled up to meet him. Its rear door opened, and he slid inside, pulling the door closed behind him. The BMW screeched off toward the wrecked fence line, followed close on by a pack of domestic sedans. Merritt emerged from the dark, smoking doorway, screaming,
"Loki!"
He stopped, clutched his UMP's foregrip, and opened up with three short bursts, expertly tagging the tinted rear windshield with a dozen closely grouped shots. The 40-cal bullets left small divots, but not much else. The car was obviously a security model.
"God damn it!"
Merritt lowered his gun and watched a sizable pack of unmanned vehicles converge like a single organism surrounding the BMW to shield it. They accelerated toward the distant fence line, running over several bodies in the process. The pack of cars was heading for the distant hangars at high speed. Merritt glanced around at the carnage surrounding Building 29. There were bodies, streaks of blood, burning vehicles, and debris littering the tarmac. Columns of black smoke billowed skywards. There wasn't a guard in sight, or any intact unmanned vehicles for that matter. They had all left with Loki. Merritt spotted a racing motorcycle parked along the wall in the staff parking lot. He rushed over to it and searched for keys. Nothing. He slung his UMP over his back and pulled his Beretta pistol, aiming it at the ignition lock. He turned his head away.
Boom!
Pieces of plastic and metal parts clattered across the pavement. Merritt holstered the Beretta, then mounted the bike. He turned the shattered lock cylinder to start and kicked the engine to life, revving its powerful engine. He grabbed the helmet hanging from the handlebars and pulled it on. He flipped down the mirrored visor, and a moment later, he screeched out after the receding pack of automated cars in the distance. He accelerated madly through the debris field and rocketed out onto the runway in hot pursuit. He could barely make out the silver BMW in the middle of the car pack, but he targeted it with every ounce of horsepower he had at his disposal. The bike engine howled. After buckling himself in, Greg looked back toward Building 29. Directly over the building, a bright red glowing sign towered in D-space, 60 stories tall, rotating like a neon sign and visible for miles around to anyone on the Demon's Darknet. It proclaimed in giant letters with an arrow pointing down, "Top Secret Demon Task Force." Greg laughed, then raised one black-gloved hand. He drew another glowing red box across D-space to encompass the entire facility. With a click of his pinky, he brought up a pop-up menu, then selected Kill Everyone. Merritt's motorcycle howled across the decommissioned runway. He leaned into a swerve at 100 miles per hour to avoid a pothole, but as he came out of it, he noticed a second wave of unmanned vehicles streaming in toward Building 29. 30 vehicles, including a couple of white Econoline panel vans. A detachment of mid-sized domestic sedans peeled off from the main group and vectored in on Merritt.
Oh, shit.
The sedans were almost on him and still accelerating. Merritt's youthful passion for fast motorcycles finally paid off. He thrust his body up and over the left side of the gas tank, expertly pulling into the hardest turn he could manage at high speed. Friction coefficients instinctively ran through his head, and muscle memory took over. The first blue sedan screamed past on the right rear flank with a margin so close the wind pounded into Merritt's thigh. Merritt leaned right. Half a second later, two more sedans clipped each other just feet behind him. Hollow, crashing sounds, as of rolling vehicles, boomed, then quickly faded behind him. The fourth one came so close, it tore Merritt's left rear turning light off. This left Merritt wavering and off balance. The motorcycle yawed from side to side for a few moments until he got it back under control. He was now highly aware that he wasn't wearing riding gear. He looked up to see Loki's pack of cars racing through the decommissioned base's front gate. Merritt shot a glance behind him. Two cars were pursuing and closing fast.
He yanked on the throttle, and raw acceleration nearly ripped him off the saddle. Merritt raced down a lane between hangars and keyed his radio.
Merritt to Seacom. In pursuit of Loki. He's headed east in an armored silver late-model BMW. It's surrounded by a pack of unmanned vehicles. More are headed your way.
The major's voice came in over the radio.
Agent Merritt, terminate this pursuit. Repeat, terminate pursuit immediately.
Merritt emerged from between the hangars and saw Loki's pack racing out into the city streets, smashing other traffic aside.
Negative. This guy's a danger to the public. Repeat! Terminate this chase!
I don't report to you, Major. Until the Bureau orders me otherwise, I'm going after this bastard. Out! He accelerated out of the abandoned front gates of Alameda Naval Air Station and hit the surface roads with a bounce. Greg cinched the racing harness tighter around his body as the powerful BMW Automate roared into the streets of Oakland. The unmanned steering wheel spun crazily as it went into a power slide around the corner. Automates crowded Greg's car on either side, muscling other cars out of their way. His entourage was a pack of a dozen sedans. He saw their random alphanumeric callouts hovering in D-space all around him. He concentrated further ahead, to the dozens more automates streaming in toward him from across the city. His strength was growing by the minute, now reaching upwards of 100 vehicles. He waved his glove hands and screeched cars across the mouths of distant intersections, sealing out cross-traffic and opening the way ahead. Greg's own pack invaded a busy intersection against the light, sparking several broadside crashes as his minions forced a path for him. Smashing glass followed screeching rubber. Wrecked cars spun out of control, and pedestrians ran for cover. Greg's BMW raced through the carnage and passed a local patrolman ticketing a landscaper's truck. Greg's eyes narrowed, and he brought video from dashboard cameras of a trailing automate up on his HUD display. In the video window, Greg could see the local cop sprinting to his squad car, speaking urgently into his hand radio. With a subtle motion of his hand, Greg clicked on the license plate of the police car, locking the nearest automate onto it. The video image disappeared in a cloud of snow on impact, and Greg chuckled to himself, imagining the consequences. On the tarmac surrounding Building 29, two white panel vans came to a stop as a dozen more automates circled around them on guard. The rear doors to each van opened, and metal mesh ramps dropped onto the pavement with a clang. A deep, guttural roar rose over the other engines, and down each ramp rolled a riderless, black racing motorcycle with dozens of brushed steel blades running along their tops and sides like cooling fins. Neither bike had handlebars, but instead had forward-mounted hydraulic assemblies of brushed steel folded tightly. A cowling of black laminate armor enclosed the front. In place of a rider's saddle was a circular steel dome about a foot in diameter, its surface etched with mystical symbols. Nearly every inch of the bikes was covered in runes and glyphs and razor-sharp blades. They were as much fetish objects as machines. The motorcycles rolled to a stop, and twin hydraulic jacks slammed down onto the pavement like oversized kickstands or half-formed legs. They thrust each bike nearly a foot off the ground, where they stood revving their 1800cc engines deafeningly. The twin robotic arms, with gleaming 3-foot sword blades, unfolded from the forward hydraulic assemblies, lashing forth on gimbals, arcing smoothly with blinding speed as they ran through diagnostics, like insects cleaning their antennae. At some unseen signal, the bikes retracted their kickstand jacks and hit the pavement, rear wheels smoking. They streaked off toward the hulking silhouette of Building 29 in the distance. Phillips and the Major moved swiftly down a corridor, followed by Ross and four heavily armed Corps guards. Personnel raced past them in both directions, carrying computers and boxes of files. The Major was speaking on his L3 phone.
I understand.
A pause.
Yes.
We're working back channels to warn off civilian authorities. I will.
He snapped the phone shut. They reached the gaming pit and could see black smoke seeping from the seams of the sealed lab blast doors, hinting at the inferno burning within. Corps medics were doing CPR on two strike team members, while other guards were placing bodies in a row on the floor. Philip slowed for a moment.
My God.
The major pulled her past and motioned for Ross to follow.
We're evacuating this facility. Choppers are on the way. I'm taking the first one to go after Agent Merritt. I want you and Mr. Ross on Chopper 2.
Where is Merritt?
He went out after this Loki person, but we can track him. His radio has GPS.
Ross noticed guards pass by, uncoiling detonator wire from a reel.
What's going on?
We're about to have a serious industrial accident here. Prearranged cover story.
Phillips snapped alert.
This facility still contains critical equipment and data, Major.
This facility is in danger of being overrun by the enemy, Doctor.
Phillips thought about this for a moment, then produced her own encrypted phone and started punching numbers.
I haven't received orders to abandon this facility, and until I do, I'm not going anywhere.
In that case,
the Major drew a Glock 9mm pistol from his coat and chambered around.
I can't risk you falling into enemy hands. Your knowledge of U.S. ciphers is too great.
Ross stepped in front of her.
Wait!
Do you want to see my orders, Doctor?
She was speechless, staring at the business end of a pistol. Ross held his hands up.
She'll go, Major.
The Major lowered his gun.
Puts it into perspective, doesn't it? Now get ready to pull out.
What about my people?
They're no longer your people. This task force has been dissolved. I've been ordered to send you back to Fort Meade and to remand Mr. Ross to the custody of the FBI.
On what charges?
Multiple counts of wire fraud and identity theft.
She stared at the Major.
That's insane. He just made a breakthrough.
This task force has been ineffective at curbing the rapid growth of the demon. Your narrow field of expertise is being folded into a larger effort. Mr. Ross's services are no longer required, if they ever were.
Ross looked unsurprised.
But I have an amnesty agreement with the Justice Department.
The terms of which you failed to meet.
We failed because task force functions were compromised by private contractors.
The Major nodded to the nearby guards, who raised stun guns.
These men will see that you're delivered safely. Resistance is optional.
Phillips kept shaking her head.
Major, if Merritt captures Loki, we can find out how they compromised our systems.
The demon won this round, Doctor. I have orders to break off contact with the infiltrator as soon as possible.
You can't just let Loki escape.
The number one goal right now is keeping the existence of the demon a secret until we mitigate the risks to the global economy. That goal is not compatible with open warfare on our perimeter or by Agent Merritt pursuing a pack of robotic vehicles through downtown Oakland. We're lucky we don't already have news choppers swarming overhead.
If we can stop this thing now, it'll be worth the hit to the economy.
I'll be sure to put that in my report, Comrade Phillips.
The thumping of a chopper was now audible. The Major spoke to a nearby Corps guard.
Hold them here and rush them to the roof when the second chopper arrives, but not before. Understood?
The lead guard saluted.
Yes, Major.
The radio on the guard's belt crackled to life.
This is Perimeter 9. Do you copy?
The Major motioned for the guard to hand it to him, and he started heading toward the stairwell doors as he keyed the mic.
This is CECOM Perimeter 9. What's your status?
Out on the tarmac, Perimeter 9 clutched a radio handset and winced in pain.
All units down. Repeat, all perimeter units are down. Request medevac and air support.
He limped painfully behind a wrecked and bullet-riddled automate. His lower leg was stained with blood just below a makeshift tourniquet. The leg was badly mangled. The Major's voice came over the radio through a haze of static.
Report on the unmanned vehicles.
They left with the intruder,
But more of them just arrived. They're forming for another attack. I'm out of ammo, sir. Badly injured.
He craned his neck back toward a chopper, angling in toward the roof of Building 29.
Requesting immediate airlift.
Negative. Just stay put, 9. Help's on the way.
Just then, Perimeter 9 heard the howl of high-performance engines. He turned to see twin racing motorcycles streaking across the tarmac in his direction. They were moving in close formation at 150 miles per hour or more.
Hold it. I've got two motorcycles inbound.
He stepped behind the fender of the car, putting the car hood between him and the approaching bikes.
They're moving fast as hell.
Where are they headed?
Suddenly, a brilliant green laser light dazzled his eyes. He held up his hands against it, squinting.
Hang on, I'm being painted by something. I can't see.
The roaring engines were suddenly on him, and he heard a deep thwack. He was completely disoriented for several moments. As his vision cleared, he had a view from the ground. A view of his own headless, one-armed body slumping over the hood of the car 10 feet away, then sliding onto the pavement. Back in the gaming pit, the Major was already gone. His voice came through on a nearby guard's radio.
Perimeter 9, do you copy?
Ross watched 8 armed guards piling black bags onto the floor for transport. 2 were staring at him with hard eyes, stun guns ready.
I guess I should have seen this coming.
Philip squeezed his shoulder.
I won't let them do this to you, John. I have friends in Washington, too.
Suddenly, the howl of racing engines echoed down the corridor behind the nearby ballistic doors. Everyone turned to see shadows streak along the corridor wall. Then, twin black motorcycles roared into view beyond the closed bulletproof glass doors. They raised robotic blade arms menacingly. The blades on the lead bike were already stained with blood. Everyone stepped back away from the doors. The Corps guards raised their weapons, clicking off their safeties. Ross pointed toward the far glass doors.
Let's get to the roof, now!
Philip stared at the machines beyond the sealed Lexan glass, the most exotic thing that the demon had spawned yet.
John, I've seen the word Razorback listed in decrypted demon intercepts. This could...
A spiraling green light stabbed forth from the face of the lead bike, beaming through the ballistic glass into her eyes. She screamed and slammed her palms against her face, staggering back. Ross rushed forward and grabbed her. He pulled her behind the guards, who were also dazed by the light.
Don't look at them! They have blinding weapons!
Then, the ballistic doors slid open with their familiar hiss, and the roar of the advancing Razorbacks filled the cavernous gaming pit. Followed by gunfire and, almost immediately, blood-curdling screams. Ross pulled on Philip's arm.
Run!
The engine roar was deafening now as Ross guided Phillips down the adjacent hall toward the open security control room door. There was only a smattering of gunfire now as the roar of the engine zigzagged across the room behind them, smashing furniture. Ross risked a quick glance back behind them. Blood was spattered all over the walls and floor near the ballistic doors. A Corps guard was running toward him, firing blindly over his shoulder as a Razorback raised twin bloody blades and screeched after him on the polished concrete, green laser spiraling. Ross turned away as a series of metallic ringing sounds, screams, and sharp thwacks accompanied the roar of engines. Ross reached the security control room door, half dragging the blinded Phillips across the polished floor.
What's happening, John? What's happening?
Keep moving!
He took another glance behind him as the same Razorback accelerated down the hallway in their direction. Ross looked away just as a laser light played across his face. He pulled Phillips inside the control room, then dropped her on the floor, racing back toward the open control room door. He kicked the hollow steel door closed just as the Razorback screeched to a stop in front of it. He put a shoulder against the door and slammed it shut, locking it. Almost instantly, a series of massive dents deformed the door, accompanied by the thunderous roar of a powerful engine,
The pounding continued, deforming the door surface as Ross backed away from it. He felt Phillips clutching for his leg.
John, I think I'm blind.
He glanced toward another door leading out the far side of the control room. He knelt next to her and shouted over the engine noise.
Nat, we can't stay here!
She gripped her face, tears streaming down from between her fingers.
My eyes! John, they're burning!
He grabbed her roughly.
Nat! Nat! Listen to me!
She stopped. The Razorback's pounding vibrated the floor.
It could be temporary.
He looked back at the door. If we don't leave here now, we're going to die. The sound of deforming metal reinforced his argument. She took a deep breath and nodded.
Where are we?
He shouted over the deafening roar of the Razorback.
Security control room.
She nodded.
We can make it to the back gate.
He helped her to her feet, and they headed to the door on the far side of the small room. One of the Razorback's steel falchions pierced through the door and wrenched free as the engine roared again. She stopped him.
The perimeter doors. We need to trip the breakers back on.
I'll get it. Just go. Follow the left wall.
He pushed her through the door, then turned. Jagged holes had been torn into the sheet metal of the other door. Part of it was broken away, and he could see one of the Razorback's gnarled, twisted blade arms through the slits. It paused for a moment. Then he heard a ping sound, and the twisted blades spun free like disposable razors, clattering onto the concrete floor in the hallway outside. Ross rushed to the breaker boxes. He stole a glance at the bank of camera monitors on the control board. One showed the Razorback in the hallway outside, reaching around to its side. A metal click-clack, and the arms rose with fresh, gleaming blades.
Son of a bitch!
He opened a panel marked Perimeter and tripped all the breakers back on. He raced back to the far door, looking behind just as the Razorback smashed the door in. He turned away as its laser painted him, and it roared across the room. Ross slammed the new door behind them, and the pounding started almost immediately. A Bell Jet Ranger chopper hovered inches above the cluttered roof of Building 29. The helicopter was electric blue with a bold yellow logo for Golden Gate Heli Tours. The major rose from his kneeling position and scurried toward it at a crouch. A crew member wearing a core flak vest pulled him inside. The major leaned toward the helmeted pilot, who nodded in his direction. The crewman handed the major a closed-circuit headset, and the major slipped it on. The pilot's voice came over the headphones.
What's the situation here, Major?
I need to get topside. We've got a demon operative escaping into the city and a federal officer in pursuit. Where's my kit?
Case on the floor, sir.
The major pointed at the crew member and co-pilot in turn, but spoke to the pilot.
These people off.
Both men looked to the pilot, who simply said,
You heard the man. Take the next chopper out.
They unbuckled themselves and, with a hesitant look, jumped down onto the roof. The major shouted,
Go!
The pilot yanked on the stick, and the chopper ascended rapidly, making corkscrews of the columns of black smoke. Chapter 44, Revelation. Merritt accelerated down an Oakland retail strip. Damaged vehicles littered the way. On the motorcycle, he was able to slip past the bottlenecks of wreckage and whipped past several damaged patrol cars to take the lead in the pursuit. Up ahead, he could see Loki's pack of cars, and he could see the silver BMW itself, protected by its personal guard detail. A minivan suddenly bucked up and tumbled out of the way as a horrendous crash came to Merritt's ears. This guy was a psycho. A city motorcycle cop raced up on Merritt's right. Merritt shouted over to him and held his badge up on a chain.
FBI!
He used military hand signals to indicate the target. The motorcycle cop nodded and brought his big bike racing ahead past Merritt.
Hey!
Suddenly, twin sedans streaked in from side streets, crushing the motorcycle cop between them with a horrific crash. Merritt averted his head as he powered through the flying debris and smoke. He emerged on the other side to see nothing but flames behind him.
Greg looked into his HUD glasses to see multiple police cars screeching onto the street, several blocks back, rack lights flashing. He crashed another one of his automates into a civilian subcompact, smashing it out of the way and sending it spinning up onto the sidewalk. He left a trail of destruction behind him as the police lights zigzagged between wrecked vehicles, falling behind fast. But more sirens could be heard ahead and to either side of him. They were starting to cordon him off. Choppers were no doubt en route. He smiled to himself. More automates were streaming in to aid him. He felt the presence of over 100 now, some more valuable than others. Another BMW 740 screeching in from a side street suddenly joined Greg's car. This BMW was scarlet red. The pack expanded automatically to encompass it. Greg motioned with one black-gloved hand, and the electro-polymer paint of his own BMW shifted from silver to red in a matter of seconds, even as the newly arrived red BMW transformed from red to silver. Greg's digital ink license plates flicked from California to Oregon vanity tags that read Gecko. In a flash, his BMW went into a power slide down a side street and left the main pack behind. Merritt was still trying to comprehend what he just saw. A decoy BMW had joined the pack, but then Loki's BMW transformed right in front of Merritt's eyes. Merritt leaned hard into the turn and gave chase. Loki's car was now bright red, but he could still see the pockmarks from his earlier shots in the rear window. He cast a glance behind him to see several squad cars race past the intersection, still in pursuit of the original pack. Merritt turned back to face Loki, then he tapped his radio button.
Major! Major! This is Merritt. Do you copy?
The major looked up from assembling a scoped SCAR-H sniper rifle in the passenger bay of the chopper. Merritt's voice came over their encrypted radio frequency again, dissolving occasionally into static.
Major! This... Merritt! You copy!
The major keyed his mic.
Go ahead, Agent Merritt.
Listen. Police are pursuing a decoy BMW. The car has color and is heading...
Static filled the channel.
You're breaking up.
Repeat. Color. I'm giving chase.
You're catching interference from the automates. Fall back, Merritt.
Police, they're...
At that, the signal trailed off into static. The major dropped the handset and spoke into his chopper's headset.
We still receiving Merritt's GPS coordinates?
The pilot nodded.
10-4, Major. Clear as a bell.
Then the demon is using GPS too. Get me over Merritt's 20.
Now, out of the chase and heading through wide industrial streets, Greg monitored a distant automate's video feed as the pack of cars he just left accelerated onto an elevated portion of the 880 freeway, smashing cars out of their way. California Highway Patrol units took up the chase on the freeway. Greg couldn't help but smile. They were closing in. He accelerated the distant automate pack toward the elevated junction with Highway 260 and the retaining wall at the steep curve.
This ought to be interesting.
He selected the lead automate in the HUD and urged it on ahead of the others. Then, he switched to video feed from a car further back in the pack. The lead car screamed ahead like a missile, then crashed through the concrete retaining wall at 100 miles.